Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. In this latest member profile, we are joined by Jim Champion. Jim's going to tell us a little bit about his background, his job as a physics teacher, why he joined the society, and what his understanding is of the Middle Way. Hello, Jim. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, Barry. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, well, maybe we could begin by you starting by telling us a bit about your background.
Yeah, sure. I grew up with my mum and my stepdad, and I had a younger brother and a half-sister too. And obviously for me, that, you know, it seemed like a fairly normal upbringing in the south of England. One of the main features was the fact that I was brought up in a Christian tradition. Specifically, it was the Salvation Army, which, if you're not familiar with it, is a Victorian offshoot of Methodism.
Okay.
And basically, we were very heavily involved in that. So I grew up with it where, I mean, not only were we talking about going to church on Sunday, when I was older, maybe twice on a Sunday, but there's also all the other things that were involved. I played a musical instrument in the band, so there's band practice. Sort of against my will, I was coerced into singing, which I did up until my voice broke. So basically singing in the choir and practice for that. There were youth clubs. Basically, it was... I had friends at school and so on, but it was kind of a community that was with me all the way through as I was growing up until the age of 18. I left it aged 18 when I was at university. I left home and I made that decision for myself.
Why?
Well, basically, it was something that I didn't really question it when I was younger because I thought, it was my whole family were into it. It was I had all these friends. Experience of community and so on, but you know, I was questioning it maybe from looking at the Middle Way thing to do with the absolutism of how do I know that this is the right? You know, there seemed to be lots of different alternatives that I came to find out to do with religion and choices to do with religion and God and so on, certainly questioning, how do I know if this is the right path? Because obviously, that's how it's sold to you. And by the time that I was able to see that I could make a choice myself about, what I believed, what was like the right or wrong way to live my life, I understood also that it was sort of hopelessly tangled up with family and friendship and so on. So it wasn't really until I'd been away, living away from home at university for my first year at university, where I felt able to... tell my parents that I wasn't going to carry on with it because I didn't, I couldn't believe in it anymore. They were disappointed, but I kind of knew that they would accept that, I was a grown person and that I could make my own decisions about those things. And I guess with family, usually there's the hope that maybe you'll come back to it. That was generally their approach, that they wouldn't particularly pressure you because they thought that you'd make whatever decision in your own time.
We seem to be talking about a sort of spiritual journey you've been on to an extent. That's a question in itself. Would you describe yourself as a spiritual person?
So the term spiritual I've certainly shied away from since leaving like church community. I mean, at the time, that wouldn't have been, that kind of word would have been 100% associated with like a Christian lifestyle and quite specifically like a Protestant Christian lifestyle, which is what my experience to church was. But certainly since like age 18, I mean, I'm now more than twice as old as that. It wouldn't be a word that I would use about myself. And certainly in the early days after moving away from home, leaving the Salvation Army, I would have avoided anything that had that kind of ring to it. But certainly, as I've got sort of, I guess, closer to middle age. I see that there is more going on in life. I don't really find it hard to phrase it really, but to have a very cold view of life, maybe, I don't know, because of my bringing up my training maybe as a scientist, if I try and look at my life in a scientific way, that definitely isn't all there is to it. So certainly if you want to call the whatever other aspect of trying to make sense, like meaning of life, or get what meaning you can from it and about it, then I'm not averse to using the word spiritual there.
What about the term integration? Are you looking to be a more integrated person? Could that be a more neutral term? Because that's often used in psychology, but, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think I've listened to, like, over the past years, been listening to various podcasts, reading various things, and different people have different ways of looking at what sort of the spiritual side means. Certainly as a teacher, I teach physics, and that seems to be that's the primary thrust of my daily work. But we're also in school have to acknowledge things like spiritual development, and usually that means all things to all people. But I think that, yeah, certainly in the context that I know from Middle Way and in psychology as well, certainly being more integrated, appreciating the different. There are different aspects to life, not just necessarily views, but certainly ways of putting things together, or if not making sense of things, then being more comfortable with the lack of sense, which is that's another aspect, something else I've had to think about. Being in the church, obviously, that I felt when you're young, it's presented to you very much as there are specific things that you believe, there are things you don't, it has specific moral connotations. And when you leave that, it's kind of, you're thinking, well, I'm mature, I'm making my own decision, I can go my own way. And you, after a few years of that, you get settled into, whatever rhythm my life was taking. But certainly you don't have that thing to fall back on. Certainly, looking at it from a more mature perspective, I appreciate that it's not quite as cut and dried as that for anyone who's like firmly subscribes to a specific, for example, my parents and their adherence to like Protestant Christianity. But it's certainly that's quite a traditional thing. What's almost, what to expect because it's so embedded in our culture. I haven't left the sort of the core values of that behind because it'd be very hard to do that.
No, I get that. But what sparked your interest in science, and to what degree has science maybe moulded your worldview of things?
Going back to school, junior school, there wasn't really a lot. It was English, maths, humanities, so it wasn't really till secondary school where. I had like a formal science education, and I ran with it then as soon as I had the opportunity. Prior to that, it was certainly I like to read, so it was in books that I got. But certainly from kids' TV. I don't know if this fits in with your memories of the 1980s, but there was a guy called Johnny Bull who did a series. It was sort of about discoveries sort of across history. And he had maths papers, and I just thought he was amazing. So I certainly got into that. There's still things now as a science teacher that I still find myself, I think, sort of referring back to things I remember from that, from like fairly early on in childhood.
On that, I know this was a bit later for you, but I've heard lots of teenagers really got into science after reading Bill Bryson's book, The Shortness of History of Nearly Everything.
Yeah, I've read that one. I read that as an adult, as a teacher. I do recommend it to students as well because it gives, it gives a very good. Well, like you say, it's got a broad enough appeal with enough detail, and it's quite nice to read the bit in there where he explained. I think it's in the preface where he says about he had this atlas or something with a cutaway diagram of the Earth, and that fascinated him. The thought that we know what's down there, even though no one's been there. That actually reminded me of the same thing that my mother did geography at university, and she had an atlas from a university course, and I used to, flick through the front pages of that, and it was the same thing, the diagrams of caves and how they formed and so on, like 3D cutaway. I certainly liked like visual things like that. I did a lot of drawing when I was a small child, and looking at sort of intricate 3D diagrams like that was enjoyable, and you could kind of lose yourself in it.
Yeah, and the whole thing like with the scientific method and the
Yeah.
and sort of falsifying and working with probabilities rather than certainties, etc.
Yeah.
Was that something that you felt very comfortable with, and do you think you use that in other aspects of your life? You know, in
Yeah, I think so. Or to some extent, anyway. I used to have a view, I suppose, like in my experience, a lot of children do, that science would provide you with lots of facts and knowledge and ways of doing things and ways of achieving things that you couldn't get elsewhere. When I was young, I was quite interested in planes. So, all the science behind that, the science of flight or space flight, things like that. It seemed like, science enabled you to do something that people hadn't been able to do before. Certainly the business to do with like the fact that science isn't entirely like that really came at university, because I mean at school it's the typical thing is that you've got this these questions and these about these things, but then the answer's always in the back of the book. And that was certainly how it felt at the time, and I could play that game of I'd learn the theories or whatever, I'd learn the applications, and provided the answer was always in the back of the book, I could always check I was right. And being right about everything seemed to be a big thing to me. But yeah, at university and beyond that, it's where you start realizing where you start reaching the frontiers of what we know securely, or as securely as we can know. And the fact that we really don't have a clue, or maybe even our interpretation of it isn't as solid as I thought it was. That was an interesting thing to discover. Probably the biggest thing to get out of university education was that to go from this idea that everything's known, it's all there in the textbook, or these things have been solved and the answer's in the back of the book kind of thing, to going to, well, no one really knows, and these are the ways that we're pushing into this unknown area. And the fact is that you can, for one person to push particularly deeply requires you to specialise very narrowly, and that was quite a thing to get a grip of. And I certainly see that with teaching students now, A-level students, the typical thing is they're not so interested in the history of how we got to this point of knowing these things. They're more interested in just tell me what's right, which to some extent, I go along with, because we've got a limited amount of time, and the A-level syllabus is still pretty much facts. There is an answer in the back of the book, that kind of thing. But I try and make sure I weave into it the fact that it's not as certain as all that, and how we've ended up knowing these things, and sort of the huge like unknowns or uncertainty about what we do know, that kind of thing. I mean, perhaps if they see in me that I'm interested by that even if they're not particularly into it right now, then they won't probably won't plough themselves into sort of very closed-minded, if you like, absolute view about what science is.
Yeah, is that something that you sort of push at times in the class as a physics teacher? For example, I mean, when science is done well, there's a recognition within science that we are fallible, so that it builds in things like, double blind trials and things like
Yes,
that.
yeah.
And so there's a, even before all this stuff, about cognitive biases,
Yeah.
there was that recognition that to avoid biases, that they had strategies in place.
Yeah. Well, yeah, certainly when I started studying physics at university, I came across Richard Feynman, who I hadn't come across before. And he's a very strong character. He's a very gifted scientist. And I got into reading quite a lot of his books, and they vary in terms of whether they're for specialists or non-specialists. But I think he was able to get across very clearly at times this like the provisional nature, for example, of science. Not that it's all relative, but certainly this idea of knowing that we don't know is one of the important things. And he wrote particularly clearly about, like you say, about the idealized scientific method, but then from his experience of how that stands up to what goes on in the real world with regards to science. Things like you say, stuff that's as simple as making sure that you're looking at or come up with a hypothesis in such a way that you're not trying to prove yourself right all the time. That was kind of as an area I hadn't really had to think about before in the world of school science, where everything was fairly specifically laid out as either being right or wrong, and there wasn't any grey or there wasn't any indication of how we'd come to know that certain things were right rather than wrong.
Did you ever get moments also as a teacher where, you know, you're talking about something that where there's a sort of mystery involved and that you can actually create a sort of sense of wonder within the classroom?
That's genuinely what, if you have a moment like that, you feel like you've really got somewhere, even if it didn't necessarily involve. And sometimes it usually comes from them, because, as in them, the students, because they will ask a question, perhaps naively or perhaps not, perhaps a lot of thought has gone into it. But usually the big, if I can get across the idea, if they genuinely astound me with something that they've come up with, or even if, usually it's a question rather than a statement or something, then that gets across the idea that I'm not some kind of, I'm not dispensing wisdom that I somehow have become privy to. It's, it's that there's still a lot of scope. I'm still amazed by what's out there, by the ways in which we know, as well as what we know.
So as a teacher, do you see yourself more as a facilitator than as font of all knowledge?
Probably my default position is the font of all knowledge, but that's not by design. That just seems to be how it's turned out. If I'm facilitating, I think, I'm doing a really good job. If I'm just being a font of all knowledge, then it gets some people some way. But it's not. What's the word? It's not really cultivating the right, the sort of approach I'd like them to take to it.
Okay, so Jim, so how did you come across the society, and what made you decide to join?
Right, it's a little bit of a long story, but obviously I'll keep it short as I can. Between moving away from home, moving out on my own in terms of separating myself from Christianity, I did a PhD, I did teacher training, I got a job in a school, a very good school that I still work at. So I've been doing that for 12 years, but part of what had enabled me to get to that point of, achieving high at university, moving on to do a PhD, was a perfectionism. And everyone warned against you can't go into teaching, expecting everything to be right every time. And basically I worked hard and wore myself down quite low with stress. And it wasn't anything specifically externally imposed. It was self-imposed. It was like the internal critic. Even though I knew I wouldn't be, I couldn't expect everything to be perfect in that kind of sense. The good thing, I suppose, is that it wore me down to a point where I decided I needed to do something about it. So looking into ways of looking at what you're doing and effective ways of dealing with stress, I came across mindfulness. And also my wife has, ever since she was a student, she's been meditating, Buddhist meditation. And she'd recommended to me a long time ago, but of course I was still a bit wary of anything that looked slightly spiritual or whatever. So she left me to come back to it in my own time, which was a wise decision. And so I did. I followed the 8-week mindfulness course by in the book by Mark Williams, and started meditating. And found that if the meditation itself, its effects or whatever aren't such an obvious thing, certainly in structuring or restructuring my life around that, making time for it, making more time, slowing down generally, helped me to stop overdoing it in terms of work. And a couple of years ago, I started looking around. Because, I'd done this mindfulness in 8 weeks thing on my own, not as part of a class, but by reading the book. So I just sort of branched out for that, Googling things, came across insight meditation, the books by Stephen Batchelor, for example. I read several of those, and they all spoke to me in a fairly, a very sensible, very clear way of going about it, not a sort of a woo way of doing it, a way that could tie in with the fact that I didn't feel comfortable holding, you know, any particular metaphysical beliefs. And anyway, in doing that, looking around things on the web, I eventually came across the Middle Way Society's website. And from reading some of the articles there, I could tell, yeah, this was something weirdly, because it was UK-based, that sort of meant something to me. A lot of the things I'd found were USA or elsewhere. And, you know, I've lived in England pretty much all my life, of, you know, the British culture. And I don't know, the Middle Way Society websites, it spoke to me in such a way that I thought, well, this is comfortable. These are fellow travellers. Is that the right word? Yeah. So I thought I shall sign up to be a paying member of the Middle Way Society, because I think it's espousing values about values. I don't know if that's the right phrase for it, but that I can live with, and certainly this idea of there being a messy middle, and part of it is about being comfortable being in this middle ground between absolute views. When, you know, people generally seem to think that you ought to take a particular absolutist view one way or the other. And that's never, ever something I've ever been comfortable doing, as far back as I can remember. So the fact that there are a group of people who are saying that it's okay to be in the middle, not to just switch your brain off, but to try and look at things in a different way, that appealed to me. So anyway, I've stuck with it, and I've enjoyed listening to the podcast. I got a lot from them because of the sheer amount of variety of the people and the themes that you talk about. So thanks for that. I've enjoyed listening.
Great. Well, you've answered that within that question. My final question is what your understanding is of the Middle Way, and I think you pretty much said that too. So that's great. You've only just recently joined, Jim, but I mean, I really look forward to at some stage meeting you in person, hopefully on a retreat or something.
Yes, it's a tricky thing to fit it in with, you know, family life and work and so on. But yes, I recently went on a retreat at Gaia House for 3 days, but I found that very, very rewarding. It was a silent retreat. So, you know, certainly that kind of thing appeals to me, and I'll be looking into where I can fit it in.
Great. Oh, well, it's been great to talk to you today, Jim. Thanks for giving up your time to speak to me.
That's right. It's no problem at all. Thanks for listening.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.